Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Chris DeMars. Chris is a front-end developer and UX architect. His passion for the web and the technologies that accompany it are ever-growing. He also has a strong passion for usability, accessibility, and performance within the web space and cares about clean, well-crafted code. Welcome, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me, y'all.
So Chris, just getting started, would you tell us a little bit about yourself, perhaps kind of how you got started in this industry?
Yep, so currently I'm a front-end developer. I work at Tuft & Needle, and our HQ is in Phoenix. I work remote here in Detroit for the time being. I'll be moving to Denver here soon. But I got involved in the web probably around 23-ish years ago, just as a hobby. And I did kind of like the on and off thing. I was an independent contractor for a little while, freelance for a little while. And then a few years back, I got my first gig in the industry, like with benefits, like legit benefits and a legit paycheck. And so had a couple jobs here and there, and now I'm at Tuft & Needle.
So what do you do these days at Tuft &
Needle? So at Tuft & Needle, currently I'm working on implementing one of our design systems into like our production code, and also working on accessibility stuff, working on a little bit of front-end performance. But mostly design system stuff and accessibility.
Very nice. And you're also a Google developer expert and Microsoft MVP. I know that you do a fair amount of speaking, both nationally and internationally.
Yep. Both GDE and MVP. Spoke at 22 events around the world last year. And this year, I probably got maybe 6 under my belt so far. Heading to Romania tomorrow to speak at JS Heroes. Taking a break after June, though. Just so I can kind of get the moving stuff, you know, under wraps and kind of have a little bit of a life for a little while instead of being on the road every week.
So how'd you get started with speaking engagements? How'd you get involved in speaking with user groups and conferences?
So when I got back into the end, like when I started to actually like take my life and career seriously a few years ago, I wanted to see if there was any communities here in Detroit. And at one point, I heard about Meetup. I was like, oh, you know, let me see if there's anybody, you know, out here in the city where I can connect with people who are like me. And there was really no meetup groups in Detroit. I think there was a Java user group. There might have been a Joomla user group, but nothing as far as like web development, web stuff. And probably, I think 2013, I went back on Meetup. And then there was just tons of meetups here in Detroit. Refresh Detroit, Girl Develop It, when it was GDI was still around. So I got involved in these local communities here, met a bunch of people. I started speaking at some of the events, like instructor assistant for some of them, helping to volunteer and organize some of them. And then a couple of years ago, I gave it a shot as far as getting on the speaker circuit. So a few years ago, I spoke at 5 events and then 22 last year.
Wow. Really ramped it up.
Yeah. Well, my goal last year was to do 20. Like I was trying to compete with Dave Pine. I told him like, listen, I'm going to do as many as you did last year or the year before. And so my goal was 20. And the 20th event that I got into was actually his event, Cream City Code. So that was really cool. That was like super sweet. He was excited. I was excited. And then I got into 5 more after that. But then I had to back out of 3 of them. So I did 22 for the year, which I was super stoked about.
So what are the topics that you typically speak on?
I speak a lot about accessibility, which is like near and dear to me. That's kind of like my bread and butter. I give talks on CSS. That's another thing I hold near and dear. I give a talk on front-end performance because I really, you know, I'm big on performance. And then I have one React talk that I give, which I've only done it once. And it seemed like it went over well because I'm not a JavaScript developer, but it worked out in my favor. So, but it's a React and Electron, and I really like Electron. So I was like, oh, I'm going to put a talk together and see what happens. And it happened. So I had to deliver it.
So looking at CSS and UX, what are some of the common design pieces that you find or where people are kind of going wrong? Could you give some like tips or tricks on, you know, people that are struggling to deal with accessibility or deal with just a good, have a good UX?
So a lot of the times, and it's really, really common. I actually give a talk about this. when you're dealing with CSS and accessibility, specifically when you're dealing with focus styles, you know, a lot of the times, if you're dealing with like a marketing team or a design team, they don't want a focus ring around elements, like around inputs and buttons and stuff like that. So they get removed. And the reason they're removed is either because the framework is removing it, or the developer is uneducated around focus and why it's important for accessibility. So you see that a lot in different code bases, that focus, the focus outline is set to none or it's set to zero. But the problem with that is when you remove focus for, you know, your mouse users or any user, you're removing focus for everybody. So regardless if you're coming from a keyboard or a mouse or possibly even other assistive technologies, there is no focus anymore. So that's, you see that a lot, and you kind of want to, you can remove it, and that's fine. You can remove it, but always having like a fallback in place and making sure you put focus styles back in if you have to match your branding or whatever the case may be. But you see that a lot out there in the wild.
I didn't know that when you removed it, it removed it for, because it's just like outline. So I didn't figure that it actually affected accessibility, but you're saying it affects accessibility?
Yeah, because if your user is coming from a keyboard and they can't use the mouse, when they tab using the keyboard, if they can't see what they're interacting with, then they're kind of lost, right? So that's why focus is really, really important.
So it'd be better to change the color or something like that instead of removing it altogether.
Right. And or just leaving it as default. Like if you can come to a good consensus about, hey, it's okay, just let the browser handle the styling, that's fine, do it. But if you do have to remove it, open up that line of communication with your design team and collaborate on how you could add that focus style back in.
Yeah, that's a new one for me. I'd never heard of that.
Yeah, there's another really cool one. I demo it in my talk. Well, I try to demo it in all my accessibility talks. It's called Focus Visible, and it's a CSS property currently because there's a polyfill out there for it. But what it does is it whitelists a bunch of elements to take the focus off. So with a little bit of JavaScript, a little bit of CSS, you can, depending on where your user is coming from, whether it's the keyboard or the mouse, it'll add the focus back in or remove the focus based on heuristics in the browser. It's really, really dope. I show it in my demos and like jaws drop and people are like, oh, this is so cool. I can't wait till the browser is fully implemented. We don't have to use a polyfill. So it's really cool.
Are there any other design tips or tricks that you can share?
Colors matter, right? Just picking colors that work with, you know, contrast, like anything that bounces off like the foreground and background. A lot of times, like myself, you know, when I first started, I thought, you know, lime green text on a black background was awesome, right? And really, really small font. Like that's how we did it in 96. You know what I mean? Nowadays, that stuff kind of won't fly. But you have your designers and your marketing team who come up with these awesome color schemes because they think it looks awesome. But what they think doesn't matter. It's the user that matters. It's the people out there that are using this application. And building an accessible user experience at the end of the day is what we're here for. So,
do you have any resources or anything that you could point people to as far as like how you figure out what colors are make good contrast with other colors?
Yep. So if you go to like if you Google like web content accessibility guidelines, there's information in there on like color contrast and in different ratios. And it's all made out of ratios, right? There's three different types of levels. You have level A, level AA, level AAA. Level AAA, you'll never hit. It's pretty much impossible. Even accessibility consultants will tell you that. Level A, if you're doing all the things right, you should hit level A. But then depending on the different levels, the equation changes as far as the ratios go. But there's information there on those. There's other different color contrast applications out there where you can test the colors. You can put in like one color here, foreground and background. You can see if it passes, it'll tell you, and then you can flip those colors. It'll tell you if that passes. There's stuff in the dev tools, in Chrome's dev tools, that'll do color contrast ratios. A lot of your accessibility testing tools, they'll tell you whether you're failing or not and how you can bump up that ratio depending on the color. So there's a bunch of stuff out there.
When we're talking about accessibility, are we talking about those with no sight or limited sight, with people that are colorblind? Is that the things that we need to keep in mind, or what are the types of issues that need to be addressed as it pertains to accessibility?
So usually, and I think this is kind of, it's like cliche, and you hear a lot of people say, oh, well, you know, they have a disability. They're either blind or they're deaf, right? You hear that all the time. And that's just simply not the case. We try to target five different types of disabilities, impairments. I don't really like calling them disabilities. So we have visual, right? So that could be, you know, color vision deficiencies or color blindness, field of vision, visual acuity. Those are different types of visual disabilities. We have hearing disabilities. So a couple of those are conductive hearing loss, sensory neural hearing loss, and a mixture of those two, which is called mixed hearing loss. We have mobility disabilities, which can be, you know, arthritis, cerebral palsy, MS, cognitive disabilities like autism, dyslexia, reading comprehension, math comprehension, and then temporary impairments, which I don't like calling disabilities. They're impairments, if they're anything at all, which would be like a broken hand or a broken finger, right? And a lot of the times you wouldn't think about this, but if you're a parent with a newborn child, right, and you have to hold your kid and you have to do work, you have to use your computer, and you can't put your child down on the ground or put them, you know, in a bassinet or a crib, you need to be able to use your machine somehow. And a lot of people don't think about that. And when I bring that up, it's like the jaws drop. I'm like, oh yeah, I've been there. I know exactly what you're talking about. So those are the five. Yeah, those are the five main types of things we keep in consideration. Not just being blind or being deaf. There's like a whole gamut, and that's just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, I used to work with someone that was legally blind, and I've since worked with a few more as well. And but they were always, you know, fantastic coders, but you know, they would have to increase their resolution to, you know, ungodly font sizes because not all applications were readily accessible to their certain situations. Then my father had MS for a number of years before he passed, but back in the 90s, and so we were, you know, experimenting with like the Dragon Naturally Speaking and those types of early voice to text tools, but they just weren't there yet.
Yeah, there wasn't a whole lot in the accessibility space. Like back in 96 when I started, and you know, I started off with a HTML 4.01 for dummies. And there was no section in there on accessibility. And if there was anything about accessibility, it was about, you know, alt attributes in your images and making accessible tables, right? And that's another thing. The amount of alt attributes that are missing from images, like that's, in my opinion, that's the most important part of that whole entire, you know, image tag is the alt attribute. Because if you have it and you don't have an image, at least you know what's there.
Yeah, that's a good point. What are the attributes that the design challenged developers of us that rely on Bootstrap and material design, what are those attributes that we need to be aware of and need to provide to our users?
So a couple that I like to talk about are, for one, alt attributes under images. And they don't have to be, you know, super long, and it doesn't have to be a sentence. The whole point of an alt attribute is to be short and descriptive. So like, let's say you put a picture of your dog on your website and you put alt equals dog. Or my dog, right? Nobody knows, like a user coming to that's using a screen reader or possibly if the image is broken, they don't know what my dog means. But you could say, you know, my blue-nosed pit bull. Like, oh, okay, sweet. That's John's blue-nosed pit bull. Okay, cool, right? But you don't want to put like a whole entire paragraph because then the user's going to get lazy. Well, they're not going to get lazy, but they're going to get bored with that interaction. So that's one. And then ARIA labels on like non-contextual elements. The rule of ARIA, and ARIA stands for Accessible Rich Internet Applications. The rule of ARIA is don't use ARIA. If you're doing everything right and you're writing semantic markup, you shouldn't have to use ARIA for anything. But there are times when you do. And Bootstrap does a really good job of this, where if like in a modal, you know how you have like an X in the corner, 9 times out of 10, that X is the letter X, or it's the character code for X. Wrapped in a span, whatever the case may be. But a lot of times you won't see an ARIA label equals close or an ARIA label equals exit. So without having that, and a screen reader focuses towards that, it's just going to read X, right? Or ampersand times semicolon. And your user doesn't know what that is. But if you put an ARIA label on it of close or exit, when a screen reader focuses to that, it'll announce, hey, this is what this is. And then your user knows, oh, I can interact with this. Exit out of the modal, shift my focus back to the main window. Same thing with social media icons. You know, you'll have social media icons like Twitter and Instagram, YouTube. If you put ARIA labels on those, now your user knows what that is when the focus shifts towards those. So those are like two main things I like to talk about a lot.
Okay, I was actually going to ask about the ARIA stuff because there is a lot of ARIA attributes that you can throw on things. And looking at it, like when I see another developer that I'm working with and they throw something in, I'm like, where did that even come from? But what you're suggesting is only use it when it's not already obvious.
Yeah. Yeah. Like if you have like a div and you're using that div to style like a widget, then you would use ARIA for that because a div has no semantic meaning. Like for a header, for instance, if you're building a header, you don't have to put a role of header on it because semantic markup by default is already accessible. So, but if you were to do it with a div, you know, div equals, you know, div class, whatever, role equals header. So that way the system technology knows that that's where that is in the experience.
What if you're still using table layouts?
Then you should hang up your hat. You should go back to being a backend dev. No offense.
But every element on my page is a div with a call class on it. Every last one of them. I don't use tables.
I only use tables in emails.
Kind of have to sometimes.
Yeah.
And you recently tweeted out an experience that you had in a bad situation in a work environment. Did you want to maybe address that or talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we can talk about that. At one point, there's just been a lot of talk on Twitter. Like, there's always a lot of talk on Twitter about, you know, toxic work cultures and toxic environments. And I just, you know, there's a lot of people out there looking for help and guidance and thinking that they might be the only ones that experience stuff like that, just because they just get wrapped up, you know, where they're at, and they might not see it from the outside. So I had to throw it out there. You know, I've been in that position. I broke down in a one-on-one with a company, with a boss of mine, because I couldn't take it anymore. The culture was completely toxic, and I wasn't burnt out from the work, and I wasn't burnt out from traveling. It was just getting to me so much that if I did not have a day to just chill and like take a mental health day, I would have lost it. I would have walked out. And people need to understand, like, this is real. Like, this stuff happens. Not everybody's perfect and everybody goes through anxiety. And one of the worst fields to suffer from mental health issues is our field, being in IT. You know, sometimes we're siloed away from people. Sometimes we're in front of a bunch of people. Sometimes we're, you know, pressured to the point where we're up till, you know, midnight working on code or shipping a feature. So, I mean, it can get really tough. And if the culture does not help with that, if they don't encourage, you know, having a healthy mindset, then it's just a recipe for disaster. And I had to put it out there.
So ultimately, a company's culture is kind of like enforced by its employees. Is there anything that you've learned from that situation that, maybe someone else could apply to kind of prevent it from happening in the first place?
Don't drink the Kool-Aid. That's one big thing. Like, I'm not a Kool-Aid drinker, but I can still see the writing on the wall, and things affect me a lot differently because I'm already suffer from, you know, depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder. So things get at me a little bit harder than they would the normal person. Right. But just like, look at the writing on the wall, like look at what's happening around you. See how others in the business are interacting with the people you interact with on a daily basis. And if people are making decisions that shouldn't be making decisions, you know, it's going to fall down on your shoulders. Like, just be aware of what's going on around you. And then if you can, separate yourself from it, like see it before it's happening and try and separate yourself from it.
And how about when in those situations where you can't, where you're sort of stuck, you know, for you, you mentioned taking a personal day. You know, how do you sort of create the time for yourself to be able to process and get away and sort of cope with those environments?
It's hard.
Is that something? Yeah. How do you handle that?
Talking to people, like if you're stuck, like there's nothing you can do. And I know a lot of people that have been stuck in situations like that, you know, in jobs all over the place, friends of mine, you know, people I know from Twitter that have just been stuck and literally they can't do shit about it. So they have to vent. That's all you can really do is just vent to somebody. And hopefully somebody listens to you and hears you out and tries to empathize with you and kind of build on that emotional intelligence a little bit to not say something that may or may not upset you with the current situation, right? I have a handful of, you know, friends like in the inner circle that I go to all the time when things are bothering me and if I ever feel stuck. And it's like they always have like encouraging words to bring me back to like level set me. You know what I mean? So I think just having that kind of outlet, even though you're stuck, is the best route to go. And then in your downtime, try and find a new gig somewhere. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I did. And, you know, I'm working for a great company. I work with an amazing people, great culture. It's fun. I get to work on cool things. So I'm happy.
Yeah, I think there's the phrase, what, change a job or change your job?
Pretty much, yep.
Yeah, it's important to have a really good, you know, social network or personal network that can be there for you when you need to vent, when you need to express your frustrations.
That's one of the reasons why I try to encourage a lot of people to get on Twitter, especially like in the developer space. I've given talks before and knew like a room full of 40 people, and I'll ask, you know, who's on Twitter? And two people will raise their hand. Wow, you guys are blowing my mind. Like, what is going on here? Like, part of the reason being on Twitter is that A, that's where the developers live, but B, build your network. You know, you'll have friends, you'll make friends. And then at some point down the line, you might need that person, right? And then to pay it back, of course, but it's always good to, you know, have, like you were saying, have that network, build that company.
Yeah, because everybody's got their own unique perspective and they can help you, whether it be a technology problem or a personal problem. You had mentioned depression and anxiety, both of which I suffer from as well. So, you know, I'm always amazed, but pleasantly so, that of the amount of openness of the technologists on Twitter that say, this is the frustration I'm having. This is the emotional problem I'm experiencing. And they're much more open about it with complete and total strangers across the world.
Yeah, it's a way of dealing with things sort of together, right? Everyone sort of says, "Hey, let's attack this all together." And I found that we're talking a little bit about on Twitter, but obviously, if you can get a team in those toxic environments, if you can get the other people in your team to maybe go out and kind of come together and say, "Hey, we're all in this together." Yeah, maybe we have a venting session, but then say, "Okay, let's have each other's back. Let's all form a coalition to say, hey, let's support each other in it." Sometimes it can even it can make those environments more manageable, and then even go so far as to begin the seeds that actually turn that around, right? It's sort of that coalition and of that teamwork, that bonding, that really gets to actually reestablish a brand new culture,
right?
And can even overcome that toxicity.
Yeah, having a team is good.
And since you left that difficult situation, have you had any other experiences, whether yourself or someone else on your team, where you've caught yourself or caught a situation before it got bad and said, you know, this has the potential to go off the rails? is there any particular tip or trick to be aware of that, to notice it and say, you know, I need to step in here. Someone needs to you know, cut this off before it becomes a bigger issue.
Yeah. It used to happen to me all the time. Especially when you're in an IT organization that's really big, like the last few jobs I've had, the IT org is really big, and seeing just different people and different players in the game making decisions that might not know what the hell they're talking about. And me, I have like a hot temper. I can have a hot temper and I don't have a filter, but that's why I have like an emotional intelligence book, because I'm trying to learn how to be better. Definitely like knowing body language is really good. And you learn that in like, when you're learning about emotional intelligence, you learn to read body language and even including like your own body language. So if I saw somebody that was going to get like super heated about something, I would, you know, pull them aside and be like, listen, you know, breathe, calm down. Let's talk about this. Don't fly off the handle. And it's easier said than done. You know, for me personally, like I can feel when my blood pressure is boiling. Like somebody says something that isn't true, in like the context of the web or software, whatever the case may be, your code, and they literally have no clue what they're talking about, like I'm going to lose it. because you're trying to contradict years and years and years of things that I never even did. I'm just writing the code, but now you're trying to say it's all wrong, right? Understanding what those triggers are, taking a step back, breathing, counting down, doing all of those little tips and tricks that they teach you to do in those emotional intelligence books helps a lot. And I think I've come a long way as far as interacting with people, not flying off the handle with shit, and just trying to think about the other person before I start opening my mouth.
I think I need to get one of those books. I've listened to a bunch of things, nonviolent communication and the how to win friends and influence people and a whole bunch of stuff. And it comes down to, I just don't understand people.
It's true. He doesn't.
What was that book? I know you showed it up on the screen. What was the name of it again?
Oh, Emotional Intelligence 2.0.
So I need to, I'll get that book and see if maybe that helps. But people just don't make any sense to me.
Yeah, I can understand a person, but when persons get together and become people, then I don't understand.
I'm not even sure I understand a person.
Yeah, once you get people together, then you're dealing with group dynamics and all kinds of stuff. So
one of the things that we ask everyone to give a little bit of advice to the people that are just getting started, maybe or early on in their career. And, you know, if you can think back to when you were getting started, obviously the web was looking a little differently then. But, you know, what kind of words of wisdom would you give them to give them a leg up?
Don't stop. You know, we have a saying here in Detroit, and it's also a clothing company, but it's Detroit hustles harder. And I'm a big, you know, proponent on hustling. You know, I started at the bottom. Even if I was slinging code on the side, I always had non-tech jobs. I drove a truck for 4 years. I worked in customer service food. I was to the point where I was rolling change and taking cans and bottles back for money, selling my shit off because I had to make rent, trying to raise a family at one point. And I didn't stop. I kept pushing. I kept hustling. I went through a lot during that time period. But I knew there was an end goal, right? And I knew I had to get there. And I didn't stop. And a lot of people, you know, life throws a handful of shit at you sometimes, but you gotta take that and do something with it and turn it into some type of energy. But don't stop. Hustle as much as you can, if you can, right? People, you know, people have to sacrifice things, and you know, people have families and kids, so it's not always that easy to hustle. But yeah, don't stop. Keep hustling. There's no crying in web development. Keep your chin up. And if people don't like you, they can kick rocks, right? You do you, and you're the only one that can make things happen. So get out there and kick some ass and take some names.
What resources might you point people to if they're getting into or dealing with CSS, dealing with UX, dealing with accessibility? What would you point them to?
Definitely go to CSSTricks.com. You know, that's ran by Chris Coyer and a handful of other amazing people. So yeah, CSS Tricks, Smashing Magazine's a really, really good resource. Let's see what else. If you're looking at accessibility stuff, you can check out DQ, DQ.com. They have a DQ University. It may or may not be paid. I'm not real sure, but there's tons of resources out there for accessibility stuff. A List Apart is really good. Scotch.io, Alligator, any Medium article. Yeah, there's just tons and tons of stuff out there.
And then if people would like to follow you, what social media plugs can you give for them?
Yep, so you can catch me on Twitter. It's Salt N Burnham, SaltNBurnem. And if you're a Supernatural fan, you'll understand that reference. You can check out my GitHub, github.com/ChrisDeMars, ChrisDeMars.com. I also own Chris.dev, I think, or ChrisDeMars.dev, but there's nothing on that yet. So, but usually Twitter's the best way to hit me up.
And do you have any, I know you mentioned Romania, but do you have any other upcoming speaking engagements?
Yep. So Romania this week for JS Heroes. And then what is next? I'll be in Burlington, Vermont for UX Burlington. May 3rd, and then I'll be at NDC Minnesota in May, and then let's see what else. I think that's it for now. KCDC in July, so got some things later in the year.
Very nice. Well, thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks for having me, y'all.
That was Chris DeMars. Chris is a front-end developer and UX architect. His passion for the web and the technologies that accompany it are ever-growing. He also has a strong passion for usability, accessibility, and performance within the web space and cares about clean, well-crafted code.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.